So long, Tojo. Hello, Junichi. The instant Dad steepled his fingers and began blessing the food, my sister Ruth's rant screeched to a halt. I tipped my head slightly, but kept my eyes on her all through Grace. Maybe she really did believe wisdom flowed from her lips, but this time she was dead wrong. I knew it, my chums knew it, and from Mum and Dad's reaction, they knew it too. Damn her uppity ideas. There was no way I was going to be friends with any Jap. Sure, World War II had ended, but for me and my pals, the Japs were still the enemy and had no right coming to Northern Ontario, let alone our hometown. And it wasn't just Rusty, Normie, and Vaco who agreed with me either. It was the big guys, Nash and Nelson. As far as we were concerned, every slant-eyed, bandy-legged Jap was just another Tojo plotting to derail trains and kill white babies. Even with the war posters gone, the pictures were still vivid in my mind. Japs beheading white prisoners, GIs skewering tiny nip soldiers on their bayonets, the Kelvinator people bombing Tokyo because now they made bombs instead of fridges. If these posters were so right a few months ago, how could my dumb sister be saying all of a sudden that there's been a big injustice and we gotta be nice to the Japs now? Dad had not quite finished with the blessing, but I was ready to hit Ruth with the logic the older guys had been drilling into me. If your sister's so smart, they'd lectured, ask her how come so many of those so-called Canadian Japs tried to stab us in the back, or why even a cabinet minister in Ottawa is saying they should never be allowed in British Columbia again. If BC doesn't want them, why should we let them come here? It was a strong case, and even if some of the logic escaped me, the passion came through crystal clear. I was ready to do battle. This time Ruth wasn't going to trip me up.
Bless this food to our use, and us to thy service, Dad intoned. For Christ's sake, amen.
The Japanese murdered prisoners over there, I charged. Beheaded them, just like that. Psss! I drew a line across my throat with a finger and squirted air out through the side of my mouth in my best rendition of a man having his throat cut. Mom rolled her eyes.
Do we have to talk about the war again? She sighed.
My sister took a pork chop and laid it delicately on her plate.
Who did? She said, passing the plate to me with a smile.
I grabbed it from her. Who do you think?
Which Japanese? She countered, calmly salting her food. The ones from the west coast of Canada, or the ones from Japan?
Nash says they're all the same. I cringed. Mentioning Nash was a mistake. To my dumb sister, he was the bad influence she was dedicating her life to protect me from. Dad motioned for me to take a chop and pass them on. Ruth cocked her head to one side and smiled sadly.
RJ, RJ, why can't you accept it? The Japanese who are coming here had nothing to do with the war. They're just hard-working Canadians of Oriental ancestry getting blamed for something they had nothing to do with.
I frowned at the word Oriental. Where'd you get that crap?
Miss Fisher, she said, balancing peas on her fork with her little pinky crooked. She says they're remarkable people with wonderful customs. They're Buddhist or Shinto, you know, and honor their ancestors.
I slumped. Cripes, here comes another sermon. Just because you're in grade 10 and I'm only in grade 5 doesn't make me stupid and you smart.
Mind your tongue, Mom said.
My sister pressed on with the goody-two-shoes routine.
They have a special day called Obon, on which they light candles to welcome home the dead and departed. And when someone dies, the candles stay lit for 40 days to help the deceased complete their journey. I wanted to laugh, but bit my lip.
I glanced at Mom and Dad, wondering how the lecture was going down with them. My parents exchanged glances.
That's enough, Ruth, Dad said.
Her back stiffened, like it always did when she got knocked off her high horse. I poured gravy on my meat and potatoes.
So you say they're loyal and they worship their ancestors, huh? Revere, not worship, she corrected.
My pulse quickened as I selected my words, trying to remember exactly how Nash had arranged them for me.
And if they're so loyal, and the ancestors are buried in Japan, doesn't it make sense they'd do anything to help the Nips, including blowing up bridges over here?
Her face screwed up in disgust.
Stay away from Nash and company. They've got small minds. Just answer the question. Isn't it true some of them went back for military training and never re-announced their allegiance to Japan?
I sat back and crossed my arms in my best gotcha pose. She chewed her food carefully, then swallowed delicately.
Renounced, she said. I think the word you want is renounced.
She took another bite. I waited for a response to my question, but when all I got was a flicked eyebrow and a smile, I burned.
Too chicken to answer, aren't you? I said. "'Fraid you might have got it all wrong, that them Japs are dangerous after all.'
Ruth pointed a finger at me and dipped her head. "'Do one thing for me, R.J. Promise you won't be mean to the Japanese students when they arrive at school.'
I took a deep breath, praying my words would not come out in a squeak.
"'Why shouldn't I be? A Jap is a Jap. There's no way I'm having anything to do with them.'
The Japanese students arrived with the freezing rain one dismal October morning. It was so dark the lights had been switched on in the classroom, but still the frosted globes were no match for the void outside or the gloom emanating from the oversized print of Tom Thompson's Northern River. That painting hung above the front blackboard and must have been put there by some mean teacher determined to remind us in perpetuity of the Northern Ontario swamp in which we lived. Even when the sun shone, we students were prisoners to the dismal, decaying, mosquito-infested bog hanging above Mrs. Helling's desk. On this morning, she must have sensed our gloom, because she was treating us to a chapter from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Dorothy and her gang, Tin Man, Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, and Toto the Dog, were closing in on Oz, and the Wicked Witch of the West was just sending the flying monkeys out from the castle to attack them when there was a loud knock at the door. Interruptions were rare, and we strained to make sense of the muffled conversation beyond our view. A moment later, Principal Brown stepped into the room with two confused newcomers, one girl, one boy, both looking like they'd been picked up on the road to Oz. Except for the windows rattling in the wind, the room was still. Rusty tapped me on the shoulder. "Well, looky here," he whispered. "Tokyo Rose and Tojo." Mr. Brown squared his shoulders. "Class," he said, gently nudging the new additions forward. "I'd like you to meet..." He raised a piece of paper so he could read the names. "Emiko Ichikawa and Junichi Takaki." Veiko Koivukoski exchanged frowns with me. What kind of names were these? If foreigners were going to come here, couldn't they at least adopt something that sounded local?
"Emiko and Junichi are Canadians from British Columbia," the principal continued. His eyes swept the room for disapproving stares.
Rusty poked me in the ribs with a pencil. Mr. Brown cleared his throat.
"And I know you'll make them welcome."
He turned and left. With the principal gone, Mrs. Helling smiled down at her new charges. Emiko tried to return it, but managed only a delicate twitch at the corner of her mouth. She looked like she was about to cry into the handkerchief pinned to her jumper. Junichi turned away as if he had no intention of being friendly. That was okay with me. He was the enemy, and I didn't want my hostility interrupted by any phony friendliness.
As far as I was concerned,
he belonged with Dorothy and her weird companions on the yellow brick road. I watched his face turn towards the front wall, unsure how he could see through those almond-shaped slits, but fascinated by how quickly they locked onto Tom Thompson's swamp. A hint of revulsion swept across his face as he drank in the dreary colors on the cheap reproduction. I wondered which of the citizens of Oz best suited him.
Tin Man without a heart would fit a Jap,
but I knew enough about his people from newsreels at the theater to know that Cowardly Lion would not. Maybe he was the Scarecrow, but that didn't seem to fit either, because anyone sickened by Northern River certainly had a brain. As October wore on, I slipped deeper and deeper into a funk. My sister Ruth was riding me at home about how nice it was that the girls in my class had taken a shine to Emiko. Each morning they would wait for the army truck to arrive from the vacated German prison camp the Japanese lived in and fawn over her like she was some kind of China doll.
Even some of the boys had warmed to Junichi, and the grade six girls thought he was cute.
As for me, I was civil with him in class, but never gave him the time of day in the schoolyard, especially with Nash and Nelson looking on. We were hanging tough. Memories of the war were safe with us. The October rains continued, which was okay, because on the one day it was dry enough for baseball, I'd made an ego-shattering discovery. Junichi could outrun, outhit, and outcatch me. The others hadn't noticed yet, and I wasn't anxious for it to get around, so each day I rejoiced at the rain. Not that he rubbed it in, I had to give him that, but I wasn't having a good autumn and couldn't wait for hockey. There was no way some Jap kid could beat me there. Thankfully, baseball was ending. But with the rain, ditch jumping had begun, and it was here that Junichi and I had our first out-of-class encounter. The ditch was in front of the school, and the sport was forbidden. But when it filled to the brim in the rain, the older boys would leap it, then dare the younger ones to try. To pass up the challenge was to invite ridicule.
I'd cleared it in the spring, but with the soaking we'd been having, it was beginning to look like the mighty St. Lawrence. One drizzly day, just after the 4 o'clock bell, I exited the front door to see Nash and Company showing off at the ditch. Instinct told me to stay clear, but if someone was going to take a plunge, I didn't want to miss it. I watched the big guys going over. Grade 8s first, then 7s, with growing horror. Soon they'd be egging the grade 6 boys to have a go, and if they all made it, the grade 5s, me. The routine was to work down the grades until someone fell in, then run like crazy. My pulse raced as the grade 6ers kept clearing the ditch. By now the whole school, including the Jap kids who were waiting for the army truck to pick them up, were watching excitedly for someone to get wet. I slumped as the last grade 6 boy cleared the river and Nash began scanning the crowd for grade 5s. But his eyes passed over me and locked onto Junichi.
"Hey, you, Jap boy," he shouted. "Too yellow to give it a go?"
Nelson and Nash snickered. I chuckled for their benefit, but wasn't happy. Junichi was grade 5. If he got his little legs over, I was next. I turned to Junichi to warn him off with my eyes. If he didn't go, none of us had to. But he had already put down his books and was backing up, gesturing for room. The students went silent. The crowd parted. His eyes caught mine. I shook my head imperceptibly. "Don't do it," I mouthed. But he bit his lip, flew by me, and arced into the air. No one with legs so short should have made it, but he did. In a magnificent leap, he was over, then kept on running, onto the road and into the path of an oncoming car. My jaw fell open. The girls screamed as the car skidded around him and drove off. But it wasn't over for Junichi. He turned, picked up speed, and headed back, clearing the ditch a second time. It was a great triumph. Many of the students began to clap, but Nash and Company were not pleased. They closed in on him and began pushing him towards the ditch.
"That's mean," one of the older girls shouted.
"Mind your own beeswax," Nelson shot back.
"It's brown," someone hollered.
Every eye shifted to the principal's red face hanging out the second floor window.
"It's the strap for anyone caught jumping that ditch," Mr. Brown yelled. "Now get on home."
Immediately, students began to disperse. Mr. Brown closed the window and disappeared. I moved with the crowd, grateful for the intervention. But as I was leaving, I heard a splash and reeled, just in time to see Nash kick the last of Junichi's books into the water.
"Don't cry," Nash said. "Your books aren't far away, just 3 feet down at the bottom of that ditch. And you Japs know how to swim. We gave you enough practice sinking your ships."
He began to whistle the Halls of Montezuma. Nelson joined in as they marched off. By now, most of the students had evacuated the scene, except for a few sympathetic girls and Junichi, who stood with the other Japanese students staring into the deep, muddy soup. I approached him. He had taken off his shoes and was rolling up his pants.
"What are you doing?" I said.
"I have to get my books." I shook my head. "It's too deep." He moved towards the ditch. "And Mr. Brown will catch you, and it'll be the strap." He stopped and began looking back and forth from the ditch to Mr. Brown's window. "My family would be disgraced if I got the strap," he said. "But I need those books." I shook my head. "They're already ruined. You'll have to get new ones." He looked at me and blinked. "With what? We have no money. Father's just started working for Spruce Falls. He warned me to look after them or else."
"What will you tell him?"
"Don't know. He doesn't get home from work till Friday. I'll have to come up with something by then. But Mother's going to ask where my books are when I get home." I looked around. All the other boys were gone. "Here," I said, handing him two of mine. "You do the arithmetic and science homework. You're good at that. I'll do English and history. Then tomorrow morning I'll come early so we can copy." Junichi stared at me in surprise. "Thank you, Raymond." I leaned forward.
"It's RJ,"
I replied in a voice so low no one else could hear. "Only the teachers call me Raymond." We talked until the army truck arrived. I watched him climb in the back and take his place on the wooden bench under the canvas roof. Around him sat other students and mothers with babies who had come into town to shop. The truck must have had a faulty drive shaft, because it whined as it picked up speed. We were still waving to each other when it rounded the corner and disappeared. Trading homework with Junichi wasn't working. His army truck arrived so late that we couldn't get everything copied before class, and Mrs. Hellings was getting suspicious. Then on Friday of the first week, she kept us in at recess. When the others had left, she closed the door and stood looking at us from the front of the classroom. "Something's going on," she said, crossing her arms. "Why has your penmanship gone all to heck? Everything you both write is a hurried scribble." I frowned in feigned puzzlement, determined to keep my mouth shut, but one glance at Junichi's red face convinced me he was about to blab. "We're growing boys," I blurted out, "and I think it does funny things to our bodies." Mrs. Helling stared at me over the top of her glasses and pointed to the spot beside her. "Come here, Raymond." I took a deep breath. Mrs. Helling's was not against using the strap, which was to be avoided, but to crawl was to admit guilt, so I adopted a self-righteous pose and stepped forward. She walked around me, examining me carefully. I stared straight ahead, right into Tom Thompson's swamp, never flinching. "You're talking gibberish, Raymond Martin. You haven't grown one speck." She circled me once more. "Have you been cheating?" I shook my head. She scowled. "Go back to your seat and open your math workbooks, both of you." I saw the relief in Junichi's eyes. Had she asked for anything else, our answers would have been identical. But on this one occasion, I'd copied from Rusty. She went over our work, question by question, and sighed as if relieved from an unbearable burden. "All right, boys, you may go."
The instant we hit the schoolyard, Junichi turned to me.
"We can't do this anymore, RJ." "I know," I said. "We'll have to think of something else." "Like what?" he replied. "I don't want you getting into trouble." He started walking away, and I fell in beside him, failing to note that he was propelling us into no man's land, the girls' skipping area. "I've got an idea," I said. Junichi gave me a troubled look. "But I'll have to check it out first. Tomorrow's Saturday. Can I come out to your place?" "My place?" he said, picking up the pace as if suddenly he had something to hide and wanted to get away. I trotted along behind. A girl stuck her tongue out at us as she twirled her skipping rope. "Well, can I?" I repeated. "I don't know, RJ. It's a long way on your bike, 4 miles.
"Bah, that's nothing.
Besides, I'm kind of busy tomorrow."
"Busy? All day?"
His nod was unconvincing.
"How come?"
I stopped and turned my back on him, uncertain what to do. For a whole week, he was the friend I'd been risking the strap for. Not only that, everybody knew I'd gone over to the Jap side. Even my sister had caught me talking to him, although mercifully she'd had enough sense to keep her mouth shut. Now he had a secret, and he wasn't even going to share. Some friend. And here I was, getting ready to take an even bigger risk for him. I glanced at the ball field. Nelson and Nash were pointing at me and slapping their thighs. And why shouldn't they, with me hanging around a Jap boy in the midst of the girls skipping and chanting, "All in together, girls, it's fine weather, girls"? Wasn't I just the most ridiculous spectacle? Junichi punched me gently on the shoulder. "Yeah, course we can meet. If we're going to be friends, there's stuff you should know. But we can't meet at the camp." I stopped looking at Nash and Nelson and turned to him. "Why not? I don't get it." He shrugged. "How about meeting at the abandoned schoolhouse south of the camp?" "Okay," I said. "But what's this important stuff you got to tell me about?" He looked at me. "You tell me your big surprise first." I shook my head. "Can't till tomorrow, honest." "Guess we'll both have to wait then, won't we?"
Of course, it was drizzling when I set out the next day, so I packed my surprise in a cardboard box and balanced it on the handlebars.
I pedaled hard, anxious to see the look on Junichi's face when he saw what I'd brought him. He was waiting when I propped my bike against the wall of the old schoolhouse. We considered going inside, but looking through the broken windows, we could see that someone had crapped on the floor, so we stayed outside on the covered veranda. White paint from the weathered clapboard had blistered into little curls, and for a few minutes we occupied ourselves seeing who could peel off the largest chip. Down the road and out of sight, a dog barked in a farmer's yard. Finally, I blew my chips off my open palm and picked up the box and handed it to him. He didn't smile, but I noticed his chin drop and his breathing quicken. Carefully, as if handling explosives, he set it down, got on his knees, and opened the flaps.
"Holy jeez," he said,
staring at the textbooks.
"Where did you get these?"
For the first time, I actually saw the whites of his eyes. "Doesn't matter. They're yours."
"But they're brand new."
Suddenly, he looked up at me, and his shoulders began to sag like a balloon losing air.
"Who paid for them?"
I shrugged. "Nobody. My dad sells textbooks in our store. These weren't being used, so I kind of borrowed them, that's all."
Junichi stood up. "You took them off the shelf? That's stealing."
He pushed the box back at me with his foot, as if petrified it would detonate at any second. I backed away with my hands in the air.
"Don't be stupid. You need them."
It's wrong, RJ. I shook my head in disbelief. We can't go on trading homework, you even said. So unless you plan to tell your dad what happened to your books, you have no choice. He shook his head, but with less vigor. I pressed my advantage. Look, Junichi, consider it a loan, okay? You put nice covers on them so they don't get scuffed, and then next June I'll slip them back onto the shelf. He looked around as if someone, my dad, his dad, Mrs. Hellings, might jump up on the veranda and nab us. Relax, who's going to find out? At last he nodded. Okay, I'll keep them so clean no one will even know they've been used. One by one, he took the books out and fondled them. There was something private about the way he did it. I turned away, staring out at the rain. Junichi? Yeah? Why couldn't I go to your place today? He got back on his knees and began repacking the books. My parents wouldn't like that. Why? Because I'm not... like you? He shook his head. Because they're ashamed of how we have to live now. I frowned. You've got a place to stay, haven't you? And I hear you don't pay rent. My dad says the government gives your adults $12 a month and children $5. That's pretty good, isn't it? The rest of us get nothing like that. He clenched his fists, then relaxed them, as if conscious he wasn't to show emotion. You don't understand, RJ. The government took away everything we had and sold it. House, furniture, father's tugboat, and shoved us into something kind of like a prison camp in the middle of B.C. All we got to keep were some clothes and grandmother's Batsudana. He saw the look of puzzlement on my face. It's a small Buddhist shrine, he said. Mother keeps it by the bed. But they must have done it for a reason, I asked timidly, praying the hard facts I'd learned from the war posters would not hurt our relationship. A lot of you people supported Japan, you know. Junichi sat back on his haunches and shook his head. That's not true. Most of us were born in Canada, just like you. Why would we want to hurt anybody here? Yeah, but some were born in Japan and could have come here to scout for things to, you know, bomb and stuff. He shook his head. Might seem that way to some, but even the RCMP told my father they'd never heard of any Japanese-Canadian ever harming this country. My eyes must have widened because he got to his feet. What's the matter? You don't believe me? My jaw dropped. I stared back at him. The RCMP? Talk to your dad? His brow wrinkled. Yeah, what's wrong with that? Father's kind of the spokesman for the camp. When someone has business with the RCMP, he arranges it. What kind of business? I don't know. Last week, for instance, Mr. Okamoto had to go to Toronto for an operation. So? So he couldn't go unless he got permission from the RCMP. How come? There are lots of things we're not allowed to do, like visit another province, or go away on a holiday for more than 30 days, or move to a new house. You mean you'd even have to ask if you wanted to go back to your place in B.C.? He blew air through his mouth in disgust. Can't do that. The government of B.C. says we're not allowed to live there anymore. Besides, what would we go back to? Everything's gone, sold by the government. That's really rotten, I said. I think that's where the $29 they send my family every month is supposed to come from. So you're right, RJ. They don't charge rent for the tar paper shack we're forced to live in, but we'd clear out right now if they'd let us and we had a decent place to go to. Is Hearst Hostel that bad? Hostel? You make it sound like a hotel or something. Before we arrived, it was a prison camp. And yeah, it's bad. The men painted over the dirty pictures the German prisoners drew on the walls, and they're fixing the plumbing and insulation, but we're still freezing, and it isn't even winter yet. How would you like it if someone jammed you into a barrack with 17 other families? We cook together, eat together, use the same toilets and laundry tubs, and when one baby gets sick, they all do. Then guys like Nelson and Nash go around the school saying we Japanese are dirty, spread disease. It's not fair, I said, banging the rail. We stood side by side in silence, communicating through our labored breathing, and for the first time, it occurred to me that even though Junichi was braver, better at sports, and probably smarter than me, he didn't have as good a future. By the time spring rolled around, I figured we'd pulled it off. Mr. Takaki had failed to notice the absence of his son's name inside the covers, and the book still looked like new. As time passed, Junichi became part of a fivesome, along with Rusty, Normie, Vako, and me. If he was Oriental, we didn't see it anymore. Tojo was out, Junichi in. We were just five friends with loyalties in constant flux, scheming together, plotting against each other, falling apart, making up. But in all that time, October to May, I was never once invited to his barrack, and he never came to our apartment over the store. If his father had walked into Dad's hardware store, I wouldn't have known him from any of the other Japanese men. Until that Saturday morning in May, when Mom stomped into my bedroom, hands on hips. "Get dressed and down to the office immediately," she ordered. "Your father wants to see you, now." Imagination racing, I threw Combat Kelly onto my pile of war comics and reached for my pants. Mom's tone said it all. I was in trouble. But for what? I strained to remember what crime could have provoked this treatment, then remembered the filthy name I'd called my sister Ruth the day before. But descending the stairs two at a time, it didn't make sense. If she'd squealed, it was hardly a matter to be brought up in the office over the store with the public looking on. It wasn't until I was climbing the office steps that I knew what was up. Dad was on his feet, hands at his side, fists clenched. Opposite him stood Junichi and his father. Junichi's eyes were red. His father wore the same look of concern as my dad. I should have been quaking, but seeing Mr. Takaki for the first time had my full attention. From the adoring way Junichi spoke of him, I was expecting Hirohito, not an Asian version of my own dad. The resemblance was paralyzing. Eyes aside, they could have been brothers. Same height, build, glasses, complexion, gray temples, scowl, nervous tic. Dad turned to me. "Mr. Takaki insists on speaking only in your presence. Did you do something to hurt his boy?" Junichi shook his head. So did I. "That is not the matter at hand, Mr. Martin," Mr. Takaki said, bowing slightly. Dad tipped his head awkwardly in return. "I've come about the books." Dad frowned. "It appears that..." "I can explain," I blurted out. Mr. Takaki stiffened at the interruption. Dad turned to me. "You'll speak when you're spoken to." A hint of respect registered in Mr. Takaki's eyes as he looked at my father. He raised his chin. "You look puzzled by this, Mr. Martin." Dad nodded. "My son will explain how he stole from you. Then he will apologize. Then we will make restitution." Junichi cleared his throat. "Some big boys at school threw my books in the ditch. They were ruined. I asked RJ to get me some new ones." Dad turned to me. "Is this true?" I shook my head. Mr. Takaki's eyes grew wide as milk caps. "My son is lying?" I looked from Junichi to his father. "No, I mean, yes. He's trying to protect me. It was my idea. He didn't even want to take them, but I insisted. I figured if the books were still clean at the end of the year, I could put them back on the shelf. And they are. Still clean, I mean, right, Junichi?" Junichi's head bobbed up and down. His father said something to him in Japanese. He stepped forward and bowed deeply to my dad. "Mr. Martin," he said, "I regret taking the books. Please accept my apologies. I shall do my best to repay you." Junichi stepped back. I looked into his father's face. The shame was disappearing, overshadowed by a hint of pride for his son. "And you?" Dad said, turning to me. "What have you got to say?"
"Honest, I'm sorry, Dad, but I was only trying to..."
"Apologize to Mr. Takaki for the embarrassment you have caused him." My reaction was instinctive, and I know it surprised my dad because we talked about it years later when I was better able to understand where it had come from. I stepped towards Mr. Takaki and bowed as deeply as Junichi had bowed to my father. "Please forgive me, sir, for the shame I have brought upon you." The clerks must have been listening because no sound came from the store. I glanced at Dad and saw that he and Mr. Takaki had something else in common, moist eyes. Dad blew into his handkerchief. Mr. Takaki removed his wallet from his pocket. "I will now pay for the books." Dad held up his hand.
"May I make a suggestion? We heat our building with wood."
I knew what was coming and moaned inwardly. "The 100 cords that have just been delivered to our warehouse are in need of piling. Normally I hire men to do it. This year I think we already have our workers." A smile rippled at the corners of Mr. Takaki's lips. He nodded as Dad continued. "If you can get your boy to town Saturday mornings, he can lunch with us, and we'll see that he gets home safely." The deal was settled. Junichi and I would pay for our crime with our labor. Piling wood was monotonous, but I wasn't unhappy. At least we'd be together. And if we played our cards right, we could con Rusty, Normie, and Vaco into pitching in. The two men shook hands in the Western way. Then Mr. Takaki stepped back, bowed, and cleared his throat. "Mr. Martin," he began, "my boy tells me your oldest son was killed in the war." Dad nodded. I held my breath. Mr. Takaki swallowed. "I grieve for you and your wife. It is our custom to light candles for the departed during Obon in August. This year, with your permission, I shall light a candle to remember your son and to wish joy for his soul." Dad dropped his eyes to the floor. For a minute, he didn't speak. Junichi and I exchanged glances. Finally, he coughed into his fist and looked directly at Mr. Takaki. "We would be honored, sir. Next August, when Obon comes around, if your custom permits, my family and I would be proud to share it with you." The war was over.